When it comes to Nuland's departure, in your opinion, it was a firing or resignation? And what would be the consequences of any of this, whatever you pick?
I would assume that it's a resignation time because of probably a mixture of personal reasons, the fact that she was passed over for the second in charge position at the State Department after all of her labors, and partially because the project that she's been at the center of her agenda for some at least near 15, 20 years, Ukraine is proving to be a unmitigated disaster. It's quite becoming quite obvious. It's a failure. It's a burden for the Biden election campaign. It's a disaster for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. It's a disaster for NATO and the West. And so I think she feels she's probably a bit discouraged, and the fact that she was looked over maybe decided it was a good time to get out because her influence was going to be on the wane, and maybe she's looking for other opportunities.
Why she decided to resign right now? What was the message? We have Antony Blinken, we have Jake Sullivan, all these neocons are still there.
Right, but she was she was the mastermind of really the Ukrainian project. I mean, that has its roots in NATO expansion, the conflict. And the Ukrainian conflict has its roots in NATO expansion, despite all the neocons' efforts to deny that. And she was a strong one of the strongest opponents. She worked for NATO. She was a strong proponent of what we might call eternal NATO expansion to Russia's borders. She was an architect of the democracy promotion program to Ukraine that led to the overthrow of Yanukovych and the Maidan revolt. She was so invested in the project that if some may recall that she walked on the Maidan Square during the protests in early February, I believe it was 2014, handing out cookies to the demonstrators, which is a violation of the OSCE's, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, Helsinki Final Act, which has a clause forbidding NATO, forbidding OSCE member countries from interfering in the internal affairs of other member countries. Plus, you had a series of U.S. senators who made speeches from the stage, including John McCain, so actually fomenting revolt and demonstrations. And then the project was taken over by hijacked the whole. Maidan demonstration episode was hijacked by the neo-fascists who carried out the snipers massacre on Maidan, which they shot at police and demonstrators simultaneously. And this has been demonstrated conclusively by the work of Ivan Kochanowski, who's a Ukrainian professor at the University of Ottawa. And she was at this is a very, very high stakes thing. She overthrew a legally elected government, or helped overthrow one. Truly, to be sure, it was a corrupt government, but simply because the Yanukovych government decided to back off on its plan to sign an association agreement with the European Union, and European Union association agreements are usually, on average, followed by NATO membership 8 years later. This was, and in fact, the association agreement even had a clause in it which said that. Ukraine was to work to integrate itself into security and defense structures of Europe and the West. So she was very much at the center of all this. She was also a protector of the Maidan myth that the snipers massacre was a result of Yanukovych sending out security police to fire on demonstrators, when in fact became quite clear almost immediately after that the event that it was carried out by ultra-nationalists and neo-fascists who had entered the demonstrations on the Maidan and then set up themselves in the headquarters building of the Ukraine Hotel off the Maidan Square and fired on both police and demonstrators, leading to agitation of the protesters and the overthrow of the Yanukovych regime. And then after the war, after the war began, after in 2014, there was no criticism of Kiev not negotiating with the Donbas. Then after this war began, she was a supporter of the idea of continuing the war no matter what, as a means of trying to overthrow the Putin regime. So, and now we see that the Russian economy is doing fine. The population overwhelmingly supports the war, although many people would like to see it end. But at the same time, they support the war because they understand the stakes, and that goes back deep into Russian culture and attitudes towards foreign powers threatening Russia. Another factor could be that the combination of the failed Ukraine project or the failing Ukraine project and the opportunity to switch to the China threat as a priority opens itself. And one of her replacement, I think Campbell was his name, is a proponent of focusing on China more on Russia. And another possibility could be, in addition to the project going very badly, about to fail, is that, and tied to that, is that the administration, there may be some people in the administration who are influential who are now pushing for negotiations with Moscow or pushing to Zelensky to negotiate with Moscow. And she may have gotten wind of that and opposed it and decided that she was not going to be able to defeat that, and that over time that would become policy. And so she decided to get out before that happened. And then there's the personal issue of her being passed over for second in command of the State Department after all of her hard work and dedication to this cause and the NATO cause and so forth. And so she may have felt, somewhat offended by that and decided she did to leave to in a demonstration of her dissatisfaction. Also, she may be being set up as one of maybe several scapegoats for the Biden administration, as Biden's popularity is very low and elections are what, 8 months off. So there are a lot of good reasons why this could have happened.
Do you think that European leaders would feel some sort of relief with her resignation?
I would say it depends on which European leaders you're talking about. For
I'm
those
talking
who,
about Macron, I'm talking about Olaf Scholz, I'm talking about even Meloni.
Well, it depends. Macron, who's suddenly been taking a very hard line, he may be actually somewhat consternated by this move. I think Scholz is someone who's kind of perhaps beginning to waver a little bit, given his comments about the French and British troops being in Ukraine and running the missiles there. And then the recent expose of the German general's conversations. He may be someone who's beginning to waver, and maybe this would actually benefit him because the less the United States is wedded to this war project, that gives him an opening perhaps to get out, because the popularity of his party is collapsing as a result of the economic damage and in general opposition to the war. In general, if you look at someone like Orban, he probably held a party after the announcement. Same goes for the Fico in Slovakia, and so it depends on which the most important leaders, right? Macron and Scholz, and then of course the British also are, except for Scholz, are probably unhappy. Scholz is probably wavering and may try to use this to, push forward some kind of idea about negotiating. It's to save his government and his own popularity, because the popularity of the war is fallen drastically in Europe. 70% don't want to see the war to con see the war continue much longer or at all. So it doesn't seem to me that again, it depends on where you stand, how you look at the whole Nuland resignation. The other thing is that it also creates the issue that Washington looks a bit confused and working at counter purposes, and the fact that Trump is now looks like he very likely could be he could very well be elected president means that the Ukraine project is very likely to be removed from the top of the agenda and probably dismantled altogether. And so that's another problem that the America, the, you know, the Washington DC looks like a very confused and an unstable place, and who knows what the elections are going to bring in the aftermath of elections. If we look back at January 6th and so forth. So it's a very difficult problem.
If Trump wins, and we know that he's not willing to continue this support for Ukraine, do you think that Europeans can help Ukraine without the United States? Is that likely for Europeans?
Some Europeans may try to do that. You know, Macron now is pushing this idea of getting a group of states together to send troops, and so he's enticing the Baltic states, who tend to be the more gung-ho about challenging Russia. And so it's possible that indeed they could put some kind of a coalition together. And also there's an idea floating around that what would be done, in fact, I think it was the Czech president or prime minister, I believe, stated that as long as the Czechs are supporting some kind of a project along French lines, that as long as some countries, NATO, European countries, troops were in Ukraine but did not engage in fighting, that would be okay. It wouldn't be a violation of international laws and shouldn't, in theory, be a problem and come into lead to a confrontation with Moscow. One plan going that would correspond to that idea is that these European troops would be stationed along the northern border, where there are now perhaps, I'm not sure of the number, but maybe 50,000 Ukrainian troops along the northern border with Belarus, where there are Russian troops and Belarusian troops, which could theoretically invade Ukraine from the north. And that would free up those 50,000 Ukrainian troops to go to the front in the east to fight the Russians. And that might be able to be done in some other places as well, where there's not a direct, where there's not direct conflict between the Russian and Ukrainian troops. They could also maybe perform some policing functions, and that would free up police and security forces maybe to add to the troops. So that may be what they're trying, the lines along which they are thinking. Seems to me to be a very high risk proposition, very dangerous proposition. I wouldn't recommend it. And especially when you take into account the fact that the Europeans are ill-equipped should a shooting war start with Russia and its European troops in Ukraine. The Europeans are ill-equipped to fight a war with Russia because of low weapons stocks. They have a shortage of gunpowder because they can't get the kind of powder that they need to import from China, because China's been withholding it for several months. They don't have a sufficient number of troops that they could send. Their societies probably would not back this kind of a war, so it would create greater instability. It would further weaken the German government and the French government, probably cause problems for the British government as well. So all these governments would just be weakening themselves and creating instability at home. So it seems an unlikely project. But again, these leaders of Europe are not really very akin to statesmen. They seem to be more like children throwing tantrums. They don't have a strategy. And when things are now going bad and they're in panic, they're sort of reaching out and grabbing any old plan they can come up with, not really thinking through what the possible consequences are. All in defense of the project to expand NATO. I mean, this is a war to expand NATO. This is a NATO-Russia-Ukrainian war. And as long as expanding NATO becomes the goal, and even a good part of strategy, given what happened with Sweden and Finland, we're unlikely to see statesmen emerge in Europe that are going to try to solve this problem with Russia and try to save what's left of Ukraine.
When this war started, Biden said that we are not going to send tanks to Ukraine, and because it's going to be World War III. But then they decided to send tanks, they decided to send drones to Ukraine, everything, cluster bombs. Do you think at the end of the day, we're going to have NATO troops officially in Ukraine fighting Russia?
Well, that's unfortunately, it's a very real possibility. It's all too real for comfort. You know, the scenario that I just laid out before is a halfway step to that, right? So if these troops enter Ukraine and they're accidentally, or if the Russians decide that these are legitimate targets, since they're standing aside Ukrainian troops, they're freeing up Ukrainian groups to go to the front. This could logically lead to a decision to attack these troops. And then you would have a question of how much further the French and the, say, the Czechs or where up the Baltic states, whoever else wants to get involved. And if that then begins to intensify, for example, they begin to send more troops, especially if this began to create great problems, not likely, but possible, depending on when it happens, for the Russians on the battlefield. One way to solve that problem would be for the Russians to extend the front, and that would be to attack the Baltic states. So they're opening up a very, they've been doing this, as you mentioned, by these gradual escalations, drawing red lines for themselves, and then crossing those red lines repeatedly. And in fact, we know, right, that already there are actually, according to the leaked tape of the German generals discussing the possibility of sending Taurus missiles to attack the Kerch bridge, or to attack targets deep inside Russia. They mentioned the fact that the Brits and the French, repeating what Scholz had said about a week earlier, had their own soldiers in Ukraine managing their missiles and helping the Ukrainians fire and target those missiles. So why can't the Germans do it? And so there seems to be almost a competition to see, you know, who can somehow be the first to put the Kerch bridge out of action, which again seems to be a fool's errand, because the Russians have just about completed a railroad and a highway along the land bridge to Crimea through southern Ukraine, so they wouldn't need the Kerch bridge for that purpose. Moreover, they'll be attacking at least a semi-civilian project, and could very possibly kill civilians in such an attack. The Russians might react adversely to that as well. And so, you know, it seems to me that it's dangerously possible that we could have a NATO-Russian war.
If that's possible, do you think it's going to be a war of attrition? It's going to get nuclear? How do you see if something happens in Ukraine?
Well, it's almost impossible to tell. But I mean, the logical thing would be if there was a full-scale NATO war, NATO was sending, you know, several hundred thousand troops into Ukraine, and they were fighting Russian troops, and they were flying their aircraft from European air bases to bomb Russian troops in Ukraine, perhaps even hitting targets across the Russian border. Well, the Russians would then start firing missiles at European targets. And so once that begins, then the question is, when do we stop using, then the Europeans will respond the same way. And then once that happens, the question is, when do we escalate from conventional missiles to nuclear missiles or tactical nukes, and then larger nuclear weapons? So, you know, again, it's this sort of slippery slope. Can they manage the escalation? Can they effectively engage in escalation management? I doubt it. So far, they haven't been doing that. So it's a very dangerous, time, and it's a full. It's a very realistic. Unfortunately, it's a very realistic potential scenario that we'll have a NATO-Russian war.
When it comes to Nuland's resignation, as you mentioned, you believe that it was a resignation. Do you think that the support that was going to Zelensky and his administration, we know that her latest trip to Ukraine was to support Zelensky over Zaluzhny. And do you think that support is going to diminish? And how do you find the Zelensky and his administration right now?
I'm not convinced that she went there to support Zelensky over Zaluzhny. I think she went there to try to get them to stop the squabbling, and that did not. She did not achieve her goal. Remember, the Ukrainians now are becoming increasingly disenchanted with Washington because of supposed delays in weapons supplies, unwillingness to supply more powerful weapons to continue to escalate more rapidly. Certain noises about Zelensky needing to negotiate and so forth and so on. And so I'm not convinced that Nuland went there to support Zelensky over Zaluzhny. In fact, she may have gone there to tell Zelensky not to fire Zaluzhny, and Zelensky posted, simply didn't listen, did what he wanted. I think that as the case is within Europe, that you're going to see more and more infighting within Europe as the Ukrainian, as the front collapses. You know, victory has 1,000 fathers, but defeat is an orphan. And just as we see division now emerging in Europe, we've seen for a very long time, in fact, going back to midsummer, August 2022, just 6 months into the war, there was already were signs of tension between Zaluzhny and Zelensky. And then you have, you know, the apparent assassination of Zaluzhny's deputy, the poisoning of the head of the wife of the head of the GRU. You have the tension that emerged between the GRU chief Budanov and the United States after that New York Times article appeared about the 14 CIA bases, which featured Budanov as the star student, and largely laid all the assassination attempts and terrorist attacks against Russia on him and the on Budanov and the GRU. And then the next day, Budanov comes out and says, "Well, it wasn't the Russians who poisoned Navalny. He suffered from an aneurysm. So he died from an aneurysm." That was clearly something he would have no clue about whether it was true or not. He said it just simply to get back at the CIA. So what I'm saying is, just as you see divisions in Europe, you see divisions in Ukraine will intensify. And that's not simply as separate phenomenon, but there are parties now that run from Washington to Kiev. And that's been true for a while, you know, going back to Biden and the scandal involving Hunter and Burisma and the firing of the prosecutor. So, you know, they're basically networks between Washington and Kiev. And to the extent Washington is divided, so will Kiev. And to the extent that Kiev becomes more divided, and Europe will be Europe and Washington will become more divided. And then when you take into account that this is occurring on the background of a, you know, collapsing front, shortage of troops, shortage of artillery, rockets, shortages of air defense, basically a crumbling front and perhaps a collapsing Ukrainian army sometime this year. Well, it's an absolute disaster. So no wonder there would be infighting in Ukraine. There's no doubt about it. And in fact, there appeared to be before Zaluzhny decided to go to London, and I don't think that that means the end to what I'm about to describe, but there was the beginning of a formation of an alliance against an anti-Zelensky alliance led by Zaluzhny, who has higher approval ratings than Zelensky, former President Petro Poroshenko, the mayor of Kiev, Vitali Klitschko. So, and that alliance, you know, still has its presence in Ukraine, and Zelensky's popularity continues to fall. And then as the front weakens and troops begin to return to the front during this, what Zelensky has called a demobilization of some troops who have been on the front for a long time, the situation is likely to get more unstable in Kiev, not more stable.
If we assume that finally these neocons decide that this Ukraine, as you mentioned, failed Ukrainian project. It's not working for them. Let's go after some sort of negotiations with Russia. Here comes the question, how much the United States, the Biden administration, is capable of controlling the government in Kiev? Is that possible for them to manage that? Or are we going to see the same catastrophe that we've seen in Afghanistan, in Iraq?
I think we're headed to a major catastrophe of unparalleled proportions in Europe since World War II. I wrote an article which I called it the second ruin, based making an analogy between the 17th century, 16th, 17th century crisis in Ukraine, in which, you know, the society was largely thrown into chaos, and there were various wars and so forth and so on. And I fear that something like this could happen in Ukraine. And actually, that may not be a good thing for Russia, because one thing that I wrote about approximately about a year and a half ago, not a few months into the war, is that one danger is that you would have a collapse of a central government in Kiev. And even if the Russians were able to go to the Dnieper, or even go to the Polish border, it would take a massive effort to rein in different guerrilla groups, partisan armies that would emerge if the army collapsed. Some of those armies might begin fighting each other. They might declare parts, say, Western Ukraine seceding from Ukraine, creating its own Ukraine. There would certainly be an underground terrorist operation in Western Ukraine. NATO would support that. CIA and all the intelligence groups in the West would begin supporting that. So to get back to your original question about whether Washington can control the situation in Kiev, I think not. The only the fulcrum that might there's a small chance it might change, it is if Zelensky changes his mind. If somehow Zelensky mustered the courage in the face of all the threats that he would face, because remember, the ultra-nationalists and the neo-fascists would be going after him. Many other people might be going after them, after him. Western governments might go after him. If he decides, some in Western governments or some of the Western governments might go after him. If he decided that he was going to begin negotiations, because at least until May, he's a legitimate president of Ukraine. His term runs out in I forget the exact date now, in mid-May. Because there's no election being held, and there's a real question about whether he's the legitimate president of Ukraine after that, because no election has been held to give him a second term. His first term has run out, and certainly opposition figures will try to use that fact against him, and they can twist that any way, which way they want. And of course, Zelensky will offer a counter argument. So crucial moment, because you have this legitimacy question that arises in May. And the other thing is that the NATO maneuvers are supposed to end, I think, at the end of May, if I'm not mistaken. So depending on what the situation is like at the front, depending on what the situation is in Kiev regarding Zelensky's legitimacy and support for him, mobilization issues, weapons, running out of weapons, and then these NATO troops that are in the general vicinity of Ukraine, in Poland, and I think there are some in Romania. There are some maneuvers in Romania. There are some in the Baltic states, but that doesn't border Ukraine. That could perhaps be the moment when, as the NATO troops pull out, Macron decides, and maybe some others, the Czechs, decide to send their own troops into Ukraine. So the beginning of summer, late spring, is going to be a very sensitive period.
Despite what we've seen on the battleground, we see that Russia may get Odessa, Nikolaev, may take these two places that are so important for Ukraine. and for the future of Ukraine. And on the other hand, we see Zelensky totally disconnected from the reality of this conflict and saying that we're going to take Crimea back. He also said that Ukraine doesn't have plan B, a backup plan. When it comes to this kind of mentality on the part of Zelensky, in your opinion, who's going to make him understand that this type of thinking is not working for the benefit of Ukraine and Ukrainians?
Well, this is why I fear there's going to be a disaster, because the only likely scenario under which he would change his mind is if the situation becomes just absolutely disastrous. That is, the Russian troops are already at the Dnieper River. They've taken the part of Ukraine that's on the eastern bank of the Dnieper River, and they're getting ready to storm central Ukraine. And he'll be in a position now of having to set up a new government somewhere in Lviv. In other words, the situation would be so disastrous. Plus, at that point, who knows what the economic situation would be like, the ability of the government to pay salaries, provide welfare benefits, ensure the food supplies into the cities, and so forth and so on. You could have a general socioeconomic crisis. And I think that I fear that that's the only thing that would wake Zelensky up. Although his words, there's a fine line between bravery and stupidity. he seems to be on both sides of the line at the same time. He's certainly a very effective PR guy. He's very good at telling outright lies and making them sound true. He's a used car salesman and using an American symbol, someone who can probably sell anything. But at some point, reality is just going to become too harsh and at too great of a disjuncture with what he's saying and what he's thinking and what he's even seeing. So I think that that's the only hope. Otherwise, without him, the central government, in theory, it seems to me, is likely to collapse, especially now that Zeluzhny has left. Now, of course, Zeluzhny could always return in a crisis if he had a plan, for example, to begin negotiations, and he still had support, depending how far along this is into the future and what kind of PR campaign is conducted by the Zelensky regime in the next few months against him, even though he's Ukraine's ambassador to London. He could conceivably come back and perhaps knit things together. I don't see another figure in Ukraine who really could do that. Poroshenko is discredited. Timoshenko has those ambitions, but she's also very discredited, seen as being corrupt. So there's a real leadership vacuum in Ukraine as well. So one likely scenario is you'd have one of these ultranationalist leaders coming to the fore, but their ability to actually gain control of the situation remains unclear. So again, you could have this sort of internecine warfare within Ukraine that leads to a general breakdown. And the Russians find themselves in a quagmire trying to put all this together, with various groups getting support from the West to carry out terrorist attacks and partisan warfare, guerrilla warfare, and so forth. So that's the situation as I see it.
Do you think that Ukraine finally gonna end up to be a landlocked?
It depends on if somebody decides to negotiate. In Russia there are probably two views, and probably the latter view is now beginning to have very few supporters. But originally, I think Putin wanted to keep something of a viable Ukrainian state, one that was loyal to Moscow but still independent. Autonomous, but not antagonistic Moscow, and, along the lines of demilitarization, denazification, and no NATO membership and no NATO troops in Ukraine, or supplies to a small Ukrainian army. Under that scenario, it would be probably to Russia's benefit to have Odessa remain in Ukraine, because otherwise Ukraine's going to be a basket case. And if it's a state that's going to be considered to be in the Russian camp, right, potentially it would become a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, perhaps. They would like to see it join BRICS. Maybe they wouldn't be opposed to becoming a European Union country, but maybe perhaps also joining BRICS. Odessa would be important for the economic viability of the rump Ukrainian state. So that would that was probably something that was still, you know, potentially on the agenda. But I think the longer this war goes on, and the more Russia is forced to hunt down the Ukrainian army, and that means occupying more and more territory and chasing the Ukrainian army out of territory and back towards Kiev and back towards Dnieper, that option becomes unviable, because at some point they're going to have to go after Odessa, because the Ukrainian army is going to be part of the Ukrainian army is going to be hiding in Odessa. And at that point, it becomes very difficult once Russia is forced to cross the Dnieper in any place in order to go after the Ukrainian army. It seems that negotiations become highly, highly unlikely.
It's so amazing to see the behavior of Germany and their leadership during this conflict. And nobody understands what's going on with Germany.
Well, like everyone else in Europe, they're following the American League, and they don't have their own strategy. And the Americans really don't have their own strategy. It's just stop. The strategy is stop the Russians. Do what you can to stop the Russians. At this point, is do what you can to stop the Russians at least until November, when the elections are over. But the Germans, you know, it's a shell of a truly autonomous, independent state. Its leaders are you know, ultra liberals or ultra leftists, so they don't stand on the grounds of the German sovereignty and the German state as a key entity in the international system. They're more wedded. Most of the German leaders are more wedded to the globalists and the globalist agenda. That's true of certainly of Scholz's party and many other parties. So that's why you have the rise of this alternative for a Deutschland party in reaction. But I mean, these people, because they depended on Washington to develop a strategy, to develop tactics, to defend them with American troops, became dependent on the American economy, became dependent on American military supplies. They simply haven't given any thought to creating a strong sovereign state with a viable security and defense strategy and military posture and so forth. And so when this war broke out, they just followed the American lead, and nothing could demonstrate that more than the Nord Stream episode. And now that the Ukrainian project is going bad, they're sort of the Americans themselves appear to be wavering with the return of Trump over the horizon. They're at a loss as to what to do, and this is a result of them not having not thinking in terms of what's good for the German people and the German state, but rather thinking what's good for the European Union, what's good for the globalist agenda, and what's good for Washington D.C. So this is the result. It's inevitable.
Do you see the Biden administration finally deciding to go after negotiations, or are they going to leave it to the next administration?
I think that they're probably just going to try to drag this war out until the November elections and hope they win. If they win, then perhaps, depending on how bad the situation is, it is likely to be very, very, very bad by the end of this year, if there's even something that we could call a stable Ukraine still around by then, then I think that it probably would go to try to begin negotiations. But by then, it may be too late. Again, we may not have a united Kiev with which to talk to and convince to go to Moscow. So this is why we've sort of headed into a perfect storm, right, where we have chaos in Washington, we have an election coming up, we have collapse of the front in Ukraine, the collapse of the army, potential chaos in Kiev, potential chaos in throughout Ukraine, and no one willing to take the logical step, and that is to begin to negotiate with Moscow, you know, at least until a time period when it's already going to be probably too late. And that's why I fear the quagmire scenario that I was talking about earlier.
this interview of Tucker Carlson with Vladimir Putin, in which Putin came to a point that he thinks that there is no need to have some confrontation between BRICS and G7. We can all work together. And he said something so different when it comes to the relationship between Russia and China. He said two words, compromise and cooperation. Do you think at the end of the day, we're going to have some sort of compromise and cooperation between Russia, China, and the United States? If you remember, before going to the answer of this question, if you remember, Obama was calling Russia a regional power. And when you call a superpower a regional power, it means that you cannot understand what's going on really on the international level. How do you find the state of mind in Washington right now?
Well, they're in denial. And there's no, I mean, they're beginning, obviously, gradually to wake up, and the Nuland resignation may be a sign. But generally speaking, you know, the military, industrial, intelligence, and congressional complex is still very much in control. And I'm sure there are elements that are furtively and furiously searching about for some kind of a scenario to turn this thing around. And that's also a bit disconcerting, because it probably at this point at least doesn't involve negotiations. And so it's probably going to be some other form of an escalation. That's deeply, deeply concerning. I don't see a mature statesman. You know, even Trump, you know, Trump is very inexperienced in foreign relations. You know, surely he would be better than Biden, because he's got at least the common sense to understand that this war is not any good for anyone. But how he would manage that and other foreign policy questions, you know, I'm not 100% confident in his abilities, but we have no other choice at this point. So, you know, I just don't see a kind of maturity, an adult in the room that's going to be able to push this to a conclusion. And it's going to be very much up to Putin to, if he decides to engage in negotiations. And that's another issue, is right now there's minimal incentive for him to engage in negotiations. He's going to have to be essentially the adult in the room, and to some extent try to avoid not taking advantage of the West too much, because likely when the negotiations take place, you're going to have an inexperienced Trump, despite the fact that he was a president for 1 year. He knew very little about he was for one term. He knew very little about foreign policy when he became president. I don't think he learned a hell of a lot in the 4 years he was president. So you're going to have that problem, and you're going to have a very, very disastrous situation at the front. So they're not going to have a good hand. The West is not going to have a very good hand. And so, you know, one fear that I have is that there may be a strategy that exists. You know, you've heard this term, the long war. They keep talking about this strategy at some point, the long war. And basically that still seems to be the mindset, even though there's no longer a stalemate. I think they've acknowledged that there's no, at least many have acknowledged that there's no longer a stalemate, and the Russians have the upper hand, if not are actually winning. And this idea of a long war, one temptation would be for the complex, what some people call the deep state, right, would be to try to drag this thing out for as long as possible, not just in November and the elections, but to drag this thing out for as long as possible, you know, assuming Biden won the election, for example, drag this out for as long as possible, hoping that maybe 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, if they can last it out that long, that Putin's health would wane, and he would have a major problem in terms of health, and that could destabilize Russia, because the Russian system is very much a personalist system. You know, the whole system really depends on Putin's authority, popularity, the legitimacy, his charisma among the Russian people, or overwhelming majority of the Russian people at any rate. And if something happens to Putin there is a very good chance that, not a very good chance, but a good chance, a realistic possibility that things could begin to unravel in Moscow. And on the background of that, if somehow they were able to, assuming there's a change in strategy, there'd have to be a radical change in strategy in the West, and they have to truly go on a war footing to supply Ukraine with all the weapons. And if they can do that and get to the point where those weapons are then coming in a year or two, and then somehow Ukraine can last out for 3 or 4 years, and then maybe Putin has a health problem or health crisis, then maybe on the background of that kind of a crisis, maybe instability in Moscow would lead to problems at the front. And who knows, maybe even some kind of a change of leadership, not a democratic regime of any sort would come to power, but perhaps someone coming to power who would be, willing to initiate negotiations. Right now, the Russian position is, if negotiations are to occur, the West has to come to us, right? You have to, like Putin said in his interview with Tucker Carlson, they have to correct the mistake that they made in March and April of 2022, when Johnson, well, the West really, Washington really, the United States scuttled the preliminary agreement between Russia and Moscow that could have ended the war really before it had really seriously begun. So what would have to happen in that situation? One could imagine the Russians coming and saying, you know, maybe we're willing to negotiate. And if they were in a position where they still had the upper hand, but it was not increasingly so, and the costs already were so prohibitive for the West that they were tiring for the war. I mean, look, the populations are already tiring now. Imagine 4 or 5 years from now. Then one could see, the possibility of talks or even something more problematic for Moscow. But one can imagine such a scenario, and I fear that there may be some in the bowels of the CIA and the Pentagon, or who knows where. Victoria Nuland's former colleagues making this kind of argument. Just stick it out for 2 or 3 years. Who knows? Putin could have a stroke next year. Let's hang on for a little bit more. It's not our soldiers that are dying.
What are the roots of this hatred toward Russia, in your opinion?
Well, there are many causes. I mean, some go back to, the pre-Soviet period, even, Imperial Russia, when, there was a great deal of Russophobia in Europe, and the Russians were looked upon as being, barbarians and uncivilized and an eternal threat because of their bloodlust and so forth and so on. Never mind that, most of the imperialist activity that the Russians engaged in paled in comparison to what the other European countries did. And in fact, in many ways, the Russians learned this kind of imperial activity from the Europeans. for example, it was Europeans who went to Ivan III when the Muscovite state was being gathered in by Ivan the Great, or Ivan III, that's the predecessor to Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, and recommended that he take the mantle of the Holy Roman Empire. Because, Constantinople had fallen, Rome had fallen and was weak. And so Moscow should become this sort of new capital of the Christian Empire. And of course, he rejected the idea. And there was this idea of the third Rome in Russia, but it was not a geopolitical idea, it was a religious idea. And it stayed religious because Ivan III rejected this geopolitical scheme that Europeans proposed to Russians. Then you had Peter the Great, who, when he first came to power, traveled to Europe and tried to get European leaders to form an alliance against the Turks. And they rejected his plan and instead talked the Russians into forming an alliance with the Poles against the Swedes. And that got the Russians involved in the Great Northern War, which eventually, along with other things, led to Russia becoming a great European power. It was not just the Russians who partitioned Poland, but it was the Austrians and the Prussians, right? So all this is often forgotten. so there was this paranoia about Russia and a tendency to use Russia in its own, geostrategic, internal European geostrategic games and competitions and so forth. And then the other factor, of course, is more more practical issues. I mean, geostrategic conflict as a result of competing imperial claims. And then in the contemporary era, you have things like different lobbies, the military industrial complex. You have first, before that, you have the Cold War, which locked in, you know, the military industrial congressional intelligence complex. And so you have that, and that lobbying group pushing for things like NATO expansion, and the extent to which Russia stood in the way of NATO expansion. Well, that's because the Russians want to expand. In part, it's you know, in part, it's rhetoric, simply using that rhetoric to enable NATO expansion. And then there are some who actually believe it. And then the idea of NATO expansion is the push for NATO expansion is a result of various bureaucratic interests from that you know, complex, or what some people call the deep state. That exists, right? Different lobbies. And then you have smaller lobbies like Russologists, Russian experts, right, who make a career, Soviet experts who made a career on having the Soviet enemy, and then the Soviet Union collapses. And some of them just made a quick transition to from Soviet anti-Sovietism to a new Russophobia, a revival of the old Russophobia that existed before Soviet power. So there are whole sorts of other economic interests, bureaucratic interests. You know, there are ideas, ideological views of Russia as you know, the whole idea of geostrategy, right? So there's an ideational aspect to all this. The idea of geostrategy in Russia is the heartland of the world island, which is Eurasia, and he who controls the as Mackinder wrote, he who controls the world island controls the world. And he who controls the heartland controls the world island. So according to that geostrategic theorem, you know, you have to control Russia. So there's that. There's the geopolitical view. There's cultural condescension, fear, and all these other economic and bureaucratic interests, you know, the most important being all those being condensed into NATO and NATO expansion. And NATO uses all of those, uses all the things I just described to forward NATO expansion.
One of the rhetorics coming from the West and from the United States is that we're not going to negotiate with Putin. They're looking for whom? Who's going to negotiate with them? Medvedev is going to get far worse to negotiate with. They're not going to find somebody like Yeltsin. It's gone. Those days are gone. Russia has been under tremendous sanctions during these 20 months of conflict in Ukraine, but their economy is growing stronger even.
Yeah, well, that's why they keep talking about, you know, we can't let Putin win. We can't let Putin win because in their mind, see, what they don't understand is that Putin represents a good part of Russian public opinion, in part because he gained control of a large part of the media and introduced some of these ideas, reintroduced these ideas. But the ideas that he's proposed are deeply embedded in Russian history and Russian culture. I mean, Russians know their history and they know their culture, and they know their culture is informed by that history. And what is the Russian experience with the West? First of all, Russia has always been very tied to the West. It's either been in fear of the West, wanting to be like the West, wanting to be in the West, wanting to be partners with the West, disliking the West, and these things sometimes run simultaneously. And so Russia's experience of the West has been what? You know, after the Mongol invasion, which obviously isn't the West, they had wars with the Lithuanians, with the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. The Poles and the Vatican organized a insurgency inside Russia that led to what they call the Time of Troubles at the end of the 15th and in the early 16th century, which led to Polish armies and Swedish armies and bandit armies and so forth running across Russia, creating chaos, famine, a ruin similar to the ruin that occurred in Ukraine. That was Russia's ruin. It's called in Russian, it's called the Smuta, the Time of Troubles. That was organized by the Vatican and the Poles, who took a claimant to the throne, supplied him with a small army, and that army entered Russia and then through Ukraine, incidentally, and went up north and eventually took Moscow, and then led to this chaos and eventually a Polish invasion. Poles occupied the Kremlin. That's one episode. Then you have know, we don't need to go into detail, too much detail about the others. We have the Napoleonic invasion. What's going on today is very much in the Russian view, is very similar to what happened in the Napoleonic era, when you have a European alliance that's pressuring Russia, and now in some ways, the way they look at it, at least threatening an invasion, an attack, and presenting an existential threat to Russia. And that's all a result of NATO expansion. And that's why Russians were opposed to NATO expansions. They had these examples. Then you have Hitler's Germany, right? You have World War I, when the Germans backed Lenin, sent him back into Russia with funding, and he eventually was able to take power on the base of that funding and his own organizational ability and so forth. And you can go on and on. In the 18th century, there were a series of palace coups in Russia, and in each one, European governments backed the victorious party, leading to the coup. So there's a history of this a negative history in relation to Russia. And Russia, it's what I call the security vigilance culture in Russia. That there's, and when Russian, and when Russia has good relations with Russia, this becomes some recessive trait, not that important. However, when relations turn bad, this comes to the fore and is a dominant trait. And as a result of NATO expansion, this has become to the fore. This has come to the fore again, and you have this security vigilance value, and this is why you have, you know, a lot of this anti-Western propaganda. This is why, going back 30 years, the Russians were opposed to NATO expansion, and it's all this a revival of a very bad historical experience that Russians have seen happen too many times, and Putin is partly a product of that. He's a Russian. He sees all that, right? And he also uses that to maintain his support. And sometimes, you know, Russian propaganda exaggerates this stuff. So, for example, there's now propaganda that the Decembrist revolt in 1825, that was an attempt to overthrow the Tsarist system after Alexander I died, that was backed by Western governments, which is not true. It was influenced by Western ideas after the soldiers who led the revolt had served in the Russian Imperial Army that marched to France in the defeat of Napoleon, and then returned to Russia, and, you know, were still kind of addicted on the idea of making history, and they had seen, you know, the model of a republic as something positive. At least some of the Decembrists did. Some of them were more radical, and so you have this long history. Russians know this history very well, and NATO, when NATO expansion began, it gradually began to revive this security vigilance strain in Russian political and strategic culture. And this has implications for domestic politics too, because, as I mentioned earlier, right, the during the time of troubles, it was a person from Russia and various boyar princes who supported a so-called defector from Russia, who then the Poles put up as supposedly being the son, the murdered son of Ivan the Terrible. So therefore, this was the legitimate czar. He was called, come to be called, the false Dmitry, the false son of Ivan the Terrible, Dmitry, and said that this was him, and they marched him through Russia, and he gained support, and then took Moscow, and then the smuta unfolded. So you have this long history, you know, unfortunately, in political science, in Russian studies, as a result, there has been less and less emphasis on, especially in political science, on language, history, and culture, and more an evidence on rational choice theory and, you know, ideas of the inevitability of democratic transition throughout the world, sort of American messianism, and so forth and so on. So taking any of these Russian concerns into account is verboten in academia for the overwhelming part. And most courses on Russian history and Russian culture don't look at Russian history and Russian culture from a Russian point of view. They tend to look at it from a Western point of view. And now, unfortunately, the Association for Eurasian, East European, and Slavic Studies is now putting the idea up of having Russian studies be explicitly anti-Russian, even more so than it has been in the past, arguing that it's actually been pro-Russian and there's been some sort of a pro-Russian bias, which is absurd from if you just look at the our media and from the books published and the books that are popular about Russia, you don't see much sympathy for the Russian position, do you?
When the Biden administration decided to put an end to those negotiations in Istanbul, did they think that they can defeat Russia, or they thought that they can make some sort of stalemate, an Afghanistan-like situation for Russia in Ukraine?
I think they believed that they could get, at the least, they could get Putin bogged down in a quagmire, and at the best, they could get the Russian army would be defeated. In some way, or that the whole enterprise would lead to stability in Moscow because of the economic pressure. I mean, they talked about this openly, so it's not doesn't take any great amount of research to come to this conclusion, right? They were talking about this openly within days after the invasion. You know, Biden went to Warsaw and said Putin had to be overthrown. He had to be removed from power. And so that was the plan. I think they latched on to this as an opportunity to finally get rid of the dastardly Putin. Right, this is our chance to finally get rid of Putin. He's overshot his abilities, and now he's going to get himself in a big problem. If we can back him up and drag this thing out and hit him with lots of sanctions, we can destabilize the regime. And the reason why they believe this is because they didn't understand Russian effect of Russian history and Russia's historical experience with the West and its influence on Russian culture and Russian thought and its attitude towards the West and how this was re-triggered by NATO expansion. So in fact, when the war occurred, and Russians saw this, right? And Putin talked about it, and it was obvious if you look at the whole history, is that the reason why Putin went in is because of NATO expansion, and because NATO was then deeply after the Maidan revolt, which was undertaken because of the need to NATO expand NATO, then the anti-terrorist operation that the Ukrainians carried out against the Donbas separatists and so forth and so on, after the Putin, of course, annexed Crimea, that all this Russians saw this, right, and they understood that this is we have to engage in this war because this is the West again. This is the old Western threat. Now in the guise of NATO coming to cause problems for Russia. And then when you add in there are other historical cultural factors like the deep ties between Ukrainians and Russians, especially between Kiev and the role of Kiev in Russian history and in the Russian Orthodox Church, right? The Russian Orthodox Church was founded in Kiev. The baptism of the Russian people and it's in their conversion, if you will, to Russian Orthodoxy began in Kiev. The first seat of the Russian Orthodox Church was in Kiev. You have a shared experience of Ukrainians, for example, when Khmelnytsky sought Russian protection from the Poles and the Crimean Tatars and the Turks. So it has a long history, deeply intertwined history between Ukraine and Russia and the lessons of history with the West, and all this created sort of again a perfect storm. And when the United States thought that they could parlay this war into some kind of crisis in Moscow and the overthrow of Putin, they were sadly mistaken, because Russians, the majority, overwhelming majority of Russians, were opposed to NATO expansion. And when they saw what was going on in Kiev, especially after the Maidan, most Russians are well aware of the actual history of how Yanukovych was overthrown in a false flag sniper's operation carried out by the neo-fascists. Then the Maidan people come to power. The first thing they do is they pass a law banning the Russian language, which they quickly repealed, albeit under Western pressure. But still, that's what led to the revolt in Crimea, which the Russians quickly backed, and then the revolt in Donbas, because we had all Russian speakers there, right? So the Russian population saw all this. On what basis would they oppose Putin in getting involved in this war? other than that they don't like particularly like war.
If you remember Zelensky in his last meeting with Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, in which Chuck Schumer said, in Mitch McConnell said that we are going to send a message through the conflict in Ukraine to China to understand what's going to happen to them if they go to Taiwan, they go after Taiwan. We know that how this mindset of the elites in the United States is taking Russia and China as their number one enemy. And if that's the case in their minds, you want to have your allies getting stronger. It doesn't seem that this conflict in Ukraine is helping Europe in any way.
Right.
And they're getting worse. And as they go down, it's going to affect the United States power as well. How these guys are thinking, what's in their mind, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, Biden, I think he's just on autopilot. He still thinks it's 1991. That's the only thing I can figure. I mean, it's destroying Europe economically. It's depleting the European militaries, weapons stores. It's exposing NATO's various weaknesses. And contrary to what the NATO propagandists are saying, that, you know, NATO has never been so united before. In fact, it's quite the opposite, right? We see the row over Schultz's comments about the British and the French. Now they're angry at the Germans. Then you have the German generals saying something similar. So they're angry. And then the British and French are angry because they see the lax security measures undertaken by German NATO generals. I mean, not in the sense that they were NATO generals working in NATO headquarters, but that they're part of a German member country. You have Hungary basically against all of Europe on this issue. Serbia very much against the rest of the European Union on this issue, though they're more quiet about it. Now you see the Czechs moving in to support the French position, and now the Slovaks are angry with the Czechs. So they've managed actually to alienate the Czechs and the Slovaks, both NATO members. So now you have sort of a divided specter of beginning with, you know, the war hawks with Macron and the Czechs. And then in the center, you have those who are sort of remaining quiet and wavering like the Germans. And then you have the anti-war people like Orban and the Slovaks. And in fact, NATO's becoming more and more divided. And this is just going to get worse as the situation at the front deteriorates and the economies of these countries deteriorate. And these leaders panicking make more and more wild suggestions. Look, when Macron made his suggestion about sending French troops, there were immediately mass demonstrations in Paris. So it's again, it's these people are basically children, and they're slaves to NATO expansion, and basically they're slaves to Washington. And until someone, and hopefully that will be Trump, and hopefully he can get his act together and start to work hard and start to understand the foreign policy and so forth, and get serious about this. Maybe he can find a way out of this morass. My fear is that he's going to be his tone is so alienating all the time that any good ideas that manage to percolate up into resolving this issue. Remember, we're talking not just about settling the Ukraine issue. Now we also have to settle the issue of security architecture for Europe. And relations with Russia, relations between NATO and Russia, all this has to be refashioned anew if we want to get rid of this potential threat of a major world war. So it's an extremely complex situation. And, you know, I don't think these people, the people who are presently in power, aren't up to it. The good news is that all these governments are getting weak. The Schultz government is weak. Macron is also losing popularity. The governments that are very popular are the governments that are anti-war. Orban, this new Slovak government, the Serbian government. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if Macron and the German government can be somehow changed, and then we can have then there'll be more hope in Europe. And then along with Trump, it's possible that they could come to some kind of united agenda about how to approach Moscow. But again, the time factor is extremely disconcerting because, you know, by the end of this year, if Ukraine still exists, who knows what kind of shape it's going to be in, who knows what's going to go on, and who knows what kind of crazy gambit these people in Paris or Prague or somewhere are going to come up with that can escalate this thing beyond control.
Do you see Africa as one of the new areas of conflict between Russia and the United States?
Probably it will become, unless we can get our relations straightened out and begin to deal not in through a paradigm of conflict and instead through one of competition, right? Economic competition, and if you want to say political competition, if the Russians want and the Chinese want to put forth some authoritarian model, and if the United States can revive its democracy and puts forth a Republican motto in terms of republicanism, not big R but small R Republican model. The liberals in the West have hijacked the word, have hijacked the labeling, and they call it democracy. What we have in the West are not democracies; we have republics. But they've hijacked the word. Then it's possible that we can get out of this morass.
When you see this conflict in the Red Sea and you see that United States that could have solved this problem in Gaza, it goes to the Red Sea to fight with Houthis together with the United Kingdom. Do you see any logic behind these kind of policies?
Again, though, there's no escalation management as in Ukraine, right? Rather than try to put a stop to this genocide or near genocide in Gaza, immature governments, unless they're under threat, should be trying to end wars, not encouraging wars, right? Unless they're directly involved and they've got involved for good reasons, right? They should be trying to put an end to wars so that people can get back to doing business and making their lives. No, what we have is a support of a Israeli government that's gone completely ideologically haywire in terms of mixing religion and politics. Basically accepting, though trying to appear not to accept, massive casualties that simply make the Ukrainian conflict pale in comparison. Instead of trying to get the Israelis to engage in a ceasefire right away in negotiations, no, we backed them to the hilt. And then we were surprised when the Muslim world gathered Shia and Sunni together, united in ways that never happened before. And then the Houthis popped up seemingly out of nowhere and took the lead in this area and started causing problems in the Red Sea. And that we're lucky that that's all that's happened so far. Actually, the situation could be much, much worse. In my opinion, if the Israelis go into southern Lebanon and to attack Hezbollah, it's going to be a problem. But again, it's this sort of black, this childish black and white world, which is born because of this American messianism about, bringing democracy to the whole world. The whole world is destined to be democracy. And not only is it destined to be a democracy, but it has to do it now, God damn it. If it doesn't happen now, then we're going to cause problems, right? And so this destabilizes the whole world. Meanwhile, we're undermining our own democracy to achieve results in this fruitless conflict, and where basically conflicts are metastasizing everywhere. I don't know if the Israelis, there's some talk that maybe the Israelis knew about this attack and they let it happen so they could go into Gaza. I'm not well informed enough on that to make a guess as to whether that's true, but after the October 7th attack, they may have decided that given the war in Ukraine, this is actually our opportunity, right? While everyone's focused on Ukraine, we can do what we want to do with Gaza and even the West Bank and who knows what else. So again, these things do have a tendency to instability does have a tendency to spread, because people think they can accomplish things under the cover of another conflict somewhere else that's engaging the world's formerly lone superpower.